With just 1 week until Election Day, outrage is mounting following Donald Trump's campaign rally at Madison Square Garden Sunday, what the New York Times called a closing carnival of grievances, misogyny, and racism. We'll speak with Gene Guerrero, author of Hate Monger, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump, and the White Nationalist Agenda, and fascism expert Ruth Ben-Ghiat. We'll also speak to Marshall Curry, who directed an Academy Award-nominated short film, A Night at the Garden, about the 1939 Nazi rally at Madison Square Garden. He attended Trump's rally Sunday. Then, as billionaire Washington Post owner Jeff Bezos defends his decision to block the paper from endorsing Kamala Harris, as hundreds of thousands of subscribers quit the paper, we'll speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning Post reporter David Hoffman, who resigned from the editorial board in protest, and with Los Angeles Times editorials editor Mariel Garza. She resigned from the L.A. Times after the paper's billionaire owner also blocked the editorial board's endorsement of Harris.
I quit in protest after the owner of the newspaper blocked the editorial board, of which I am a part, from endorsing anybody. We wanted to endorse Kamala Harris and thought there was no other alternative. And he said no without a reason. I thought it was really important to take a stand in these really dangerous times.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In northern Gaza, at least 93 Palestinians, including children, were killed today when an Israeli airstrike leveled a five-story apartment building sheltering displaced families in Beit Lahia. Dozens of wounded people were rushed to the Kamel Adwan Hospital, only to be denied care. Just one doctor and a few exhausted medical workers remain at the hospital after Israeli forces in recent days raided the facility, separated men and women, arrested much of the remaining staff and patients. UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk has called Israel's ongoing siege of northern Gaza the darkest moment of the conflict.
The Israeli government's policies and practices risk emptying the area of all Palestinians. We are facing what could amount to atrocity crimes, including potentially extending to crimes against humanity.
Israel's parliament, the Knesset, has approved a law banning the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine from operating inside Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. The UN agency, known as UNRWA, is tasked with providing food, health care and social services to Palestinians as a critical lifeline to Gaza's surviving 2.3 million residents who face widespread famine and malnutrition due to Israel's unrelenting year-long assault. The ban on UNRWA was approved in a 92-10 vote with the full support of the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's ruling Likud party. Israeli lawmaker Sharon Haskell co-authored the legislation.
If the United Nations is not willing to clean this organization from terrorism, from Hamas activists, then we have to take measures to make sure that they cannot harm our people ever again.
Philippe Lazzarini, the head of UNRWA, called the bill's passage a dangerous precedent, collective punishment, and a violation of the UN Charter and international law. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called it unacceptable and said the ban would have devastating consequences for Palestinian refugees. Its passage has increased support for a Palestinian Authority initiative to expel Israel from the United Nations General Assembly. Lebanon's health ministry says at least 60 people were killed as Israeli strikes pounded the eastern Bekaa Valley, including the city of Baalbek. At least two of the dead were children. The killings bring the death toll from Israeli attacks on Lebanon to over 2,700. Meanwhile, multiple Israeli airstrikes on Monday collapsed entire residential buildings and sparked fires in the southern port city of Tyre. A survivor said the attacks were aimed at civilians.
What do you expect us to do? They fired at random. They are not hitting military targets. They are only targeting civilians. Can you see people fighting? Why are they targeting us? Are we fighting them?
Meanwhile, Hezbollah has announced Naim Qassem will succeed Hassan Nasrallah as Secretary General following Israel's assassination of Nasrallah in an airstrike last month. Qassem said Hezbollah fighters are continuing to repel Israeli attacks along the border and that the group's military structure remains intact. South Africa Monday filed over 750 pages of evidence in its genocide case against Israel at the International Court of Justice in The Hague. South Africa says the documents lay out how Israel is, quote, promoting the destruction of Palestinians living in Gaza, physically killing them with an assortment of destructive weapons, depriving them access to humanitarian assistance, causing conditions of life which are aimed at their physical destruction, and using starvation as a weapon of war and to further Israel's aims to depopulate Gaza through mass death and forced displacement of Palestinians, unquote. Over 30 countries and regional blocs are supporting South Africa's case at the International Court of Justice. In Jerusalem, hundreds of protesters rallied outside Israel's Knesset Monday to demand a Gaza ceasefire deal and an exchange of hostages. Israeli police arrested 9 of the protesters as they nonviolently blocked a road near the residence of Prime Minister Netanyahu.
It's solidarity with the hostages. We want our prime minister to make a deal, to cut a deal. We want the war to stop. We want the stop of killing and everything. We want, a sane country. That's it. We want to live. I'm 55 years old. I have 4 kids. I'm doing this for my kids.
More than 1,000 writers and publishing industry figures have signed on to what they're calling the largest ever cultural boycott against Israeli institutions. In an open letter, the authors denounce the ongoing genocide in Gaza, writing, quote, Israeli cultural institutions, often working directly with the state, have been crucial in obfuscating, disguising, and art-washing the dispossession and oppression of millions of Palestinians for decades, unquote. Donald Trump is appearing before supporters in Allentown, Pennsylvania today as fallout mounts over his racist Madison Square Garden rally, which included this now viral so-called joke from the right-wing so-called comic Tony Hinchcliffe.
There's a lot going on. Like, I don't know if you guys know this, but there's literally a floating island of garbage in the middle of the ocean right now. Yeah, I think it's called Puerto Rico.
Allentown, Pennsylvania is a majority Latinx city, home to 34,000 Puerto Ricans. Pennsylvania, the state, is home to 450,000 Puerto Ricans. Puerto Rican celebrities, including Bad Bunny and Ricky Martin, showed their support for Kamala Harris following the comments. Bad Bunny endorsed her. CNN has banned the right-wing commentator Ryan Gerdusky after he told Zateo journalist Mehdi Hassan on air, quote, I hope your beeper doesn't go off. It was a reference to Israel's terrorist attack in Lebanon last month that killed 37 people and injured thousands by implanting and detonating explosives and personal pager devices. This is their exchange Monday on CNN Newsnight.
Nobody wants to be called Nazis. It's very inflammatory. But if you don't want to be called Nazis, stop doing—
You're called an anti-Semite more than anyone else's table.
Yeah.
And people sit there and— No, by me. I never called you an anti-Semite. I mean, I'm not sitting here saying—
I
don't—
I'm a supporter of the Palestinians, so I'm used to it.
Yeah, I hope your beeper doesn't go off. The thing is that—
Did you just say I should die?
You should not—
No.
Did you just say I should be killed?
No.
Host Abby Phillip apologized to Mehdi Hassan following the incident, and CNN released a statement reading, quote, there is zero room for racism or bigotry at CNN or on our air. Philadelphia's District Attorney Larry Krasner suing Elon Musk over his $1 million daily giveaways to Pennsylvania voters, calling it a, quote, illegal lottery scheme. Musk's super PAC has already handed out over $9 million to swing state voters, roughly half of them in Pennsylvania. Donald Trump's vowed to create an official position for Musk and his administration if Trump is reelected. The FBI says it's investigating 3 separate but related arson attacks on ballot boxes in the Pacific Northwest. One of the attacks destroyed hundreds of ballots in Washington State's Clark County, a precinct that's home to a closely watched congressional race in Vancouver. Other attacks damaged ballot boxes in Portland, Oregon, and nearby Vancouver, Washington. Police in Portland have identified a suspect vehicle in the case. Oregon's Secretary of State condemned the arson as, quote, an attack on our democracy, unquote. And the World Meteorological Association warned Monday the world is falling miles short on action to stave off the worst impacts of climate change, with carbon dioxide concentrations soaring to a record high of 420 parts per million last year. The WMO says the last time the Earth's atmosphere held so much carbon dioxide was 3 to 5 million years ago, when global temperatures were up to 4 degrees Celsius warmer and sea levels were 10 to 20 meters higher. Coe Barrett is the WMO's Deputy Secretary General.
Carbon dioxide is accumulating in the atmosphere faster than at any time experienced during human existence. And because of the extremely long lifetime of CO2 in the atmosphere, we are committed to rising temperatures for many, many years to come.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, with just 1 week until Election Day, outrage is mounting following Donald Trump's campaign rally at Madison Square Garden Sunday. The New York Times described it as a closing carnival of grievances, misogyny, and racism, unquote. During the event, one speaker described Puerto Rico as an island of garbage. Trump also continued to spew his racist rants and lies about immigrants, doubling down on his promise to enforce, quote, the largest deportation program in American history, unquote, and claiming the United States is now an occupied country. Trump also described Democrats as the enemy from within. Other speakers included Trump's running mate J.D. Vance, tech billionaire Elon Musk, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Tucker Carlson, Hulk Hogan, Stephen Miller, the architect of Trump's white nationalist anti-immigrant policies, which include the separation of families seeking asylum in the U.S.-Mexico border. These are some of the voices from the rally.
The United States is now an occupied country, but it will soon be an occupied country no longer. On day one, I will launch the largest deportation program in American history.
America is for Americans and Americans only.
It's going to be pretty hard to look at us and say, you know what? Kamala Harris, she got 85 million votes because she's just so impressive. As the first Samoan Malaysian low IQ former California prosecutor ever to be elected president.
She is the devil, whoever screamed that out. She is the Antichrist.
She is some sick bastard, that Hillary Clinton, huh? What a sick son of a bitch. The whole party, a bunch of degenerates, low lives, Jew haters, and low lives.
And these Latinos, they love making babies, too. Just know that. They do. They do. There's no pulling out. They don't do that. They come inside, just like they did to our country. Republicans are the party with a good sense of humor. There's a lot going on. Like, I don't know if you guys know this, but there's literally a floating island of garbage in the middle of the ocean right now. Yeah. I think it's called Puerto Rico.
There's literally a floating island of garbage in the middle of the ocean right now. I think it's called Puerto Rico. Those are the words of the conservative so-called comedian Tony Hinchcliffe at Trump's rally Sunday in Madison Square Garden. Trump's campaign has faced widespread anger and condemnation from elected officials, Latino groups, prominent Puerto Rican leaders from both political parties, including the head of Puerto Rico's Republican Party, as well as Republican Congress member Maria Alvarez Salazar, who represents parts of Miami and has attended Trump rallies. Vice President Kamala Harris called the remarks nonsense, while Puerto Rican music stars Bad Bunny and Ricky Martin quickly announced their endorsement of Harris following Trump's rally. Reactions to the racist comments included this response on ABC's The View from co-host Sunny Hostin. Her mother is Puerto Rico. Hostin looked into the camera as she addressed Trump directly.
Puerto Rico is trash. We are Americans, Donald Trump. Americans. And we vote. Pennsylvania is home to almost 500,000 Puerto Ricans. North Carolina, 115,000. Georgia, 100,000. Arizona, 64,000. Wisconsin, 61,000. Michigan, 43,000. Nevada, 27,000. We vote Donald Trump. Trash.
For more, we go to Los Angeles, where we're joined by Jean Guerrero, contributing opinion writer for The New York Times, author of the book Hate Monger, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump and the White Nationalist Agenda, and Crux, a cross-border memoir, which won a Penn Literary Award. She's a senior journalism fellow at the UCLA Latina Futures 2050 Lab. Jean, welcome back to Democracy Now! Well, why don't you just respond to what happened on Sunday? 20,000 people gathered at Madison Square Garden. Talk about what they heard.
Well, what we saw there was an extreme escalation of the Latinophobic rhetoric that has defined the Trump campaign. And I want to respond, first of all, to the comments that were made about Puerto Rico. As a Puerto Rican woman with family on the island who was raised by a Puerto Rican mother who taught me to love this country, to work hard for this country, to defend the vulnerable in this country, all of which are appear to be foreign concepts to Donald Trump. I felt very personally offended by these comments, but also was filled with a renewed conviction to defeat Trump, which I think a lot of Puerto Ricans are feeling right now. The bottom line is these comments are evidence that the Trump campaign has nothing to offer the American people besides more hate and more division. They want to divide the Puerto Rican diaspora from the residents of the island. They want to divide Mexican Americans from Central American immigrants. They want to divide Latino men from Latina women. But these divisive tactics are not going to work. They've become extremely old, and people, Latina women and Latinos in general, are organizing in response to this extremely racist rally and making sure that they're going to defend their communities. But in general, what these comments also show during this rally is that they're seeking to restrict the notion of what it means to be American, who is American, as we saw from Stephen Miller's comments about America is for Americans only. They're trying to restrict what it means to be American and laundering it through racist jokes. But newsflash to the Trump campaign, as other speakers have said before, Puerto Ricans are Americans, they are citizens, and they're going to vote. They're going to make sure that Trump never again steps foot in the White House.
And Jean, I'm wondering if you could talk about the potential impact of this, especially in Pennsylvania, where not only is Philadelphia the home of the second largest Puerto Rican population in the U.S. For of any city after New York. But there are these other cities in Pennsylvania. Reading is 67% Latino, and Allentown, 54%, Lancaster, 40%. There's an enormous, and most of these are Puerto Ricans. There's an enormous Puerto Rican population in all these small towns in Pennsylvania, in addition to Philadelphia, that I'm sure this is going to have a enormous effect on as these folks go to the polls this week.
Absolutely. I mean, Puerto Ricans are something like half of the Latino vote in Pennsylvania and are a significant portion of the Latino vote and of the vote in general in the other battleground states. And so I think what we're going to see as a result of this completely unacceptable rhetoric is the mobilization of the Puerto Rican vote. And we're going to see people show Donald Trump that we are not going to be divided, that the Puerto Rican diaspora, regardless of not living on the island, we have family on the island, we are proud to be Puerto Rican. And what that also means is that we're proud to be American. When the Republicans are trashing Puerto Rico, they're trashing America. And it's no different from the way that Donald Trump talks about the the United States as a dumping ground. Love of country has become a completely foreign concept to the Republican Party, as revealed by their complete disdain for Latino Americans, for Puerto Rico, and for anyone from the region of Latin America. And what you're going to see as a result of that open disdain, which has been going on for years but has been significantly escalated as of the past couple of days, is a historic mobilization of the Latino vote. And we're going to make sure that Donald Trump never again is able to wield his power to oppress our communities.
And I'm wondering if you could comment as well about the comedian who opened this rally, the patently and really nakedly racist comments he made about other Latinos, about Palestinians, and in general, his remarks.
I mean, all of these remarks, it's interesting that they choose to put these comedians forward, but it's not a surprise at all. The laundering of white supremacy through so-called comedy is a common tactic. But when you look at the white supremacist texts and publications that have inspired top Trump advisors like Stephen Miller, it is very clear that they believe in the racial inferiority of people of color, and that not only that, but that they promote violence towards these communities. The end goal of Trump's anti-immigrant and racist rhetoric is violence towards these communities. You know, they want to create an atmosphere of unsafety for communities of color across this nation. And it's very serious. It's not a joke. You know, they are trying to launder this through comedy. But when you look at what these people actually believe, what they have advocated for, and the policies that they have put in place previously and that they plan to put in place in a second Trump term, these are extremely serious and potentially deadly actions that would separate millions of mixed-status families across the United States. Trump's mass deportations in a second term would be—they would make his family separations from his first term look restrained. They would be separating millions of undocumented mothers and fathers from U.S. citizen children across this country, leaving them financially and psychologically devastated. We've already seen the consequences of this in a first Trump term, and they would be unimaginably worse in a second one.
I wanted to play a few clips, Jane Guerrero. First, Trump's former lawyer, the former mayor of New York City, Rudy Giuliani, who went on an anti-Palestinian rant as he took the stage.
Hamas is not there for us. Iran is not there for us. They want to kill us. And the Palestinians are taught to kill us at 2 years old.
Last week, a federal judge ordered Rudy Giuliani to hand over his luxury Manhattan apartment and other costly possessions to a pair of Georgia election workers who he defamed after Trump lost in 2020. Now, as this what the Times called carnival took place, Kamala Harris lost no time, especially on the attack on Puerto Ricans. On Sunday morning, she went to a Puerto Rican restaurant in Philadelphia. She also had released an ad there. But after this campaign rally of President Trump, Kamala Harris released another ad.
A floating island of garbage in the middle of the ocean. I think it's called Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico.
I will never forget what Donald Trump did. He abandoned the island and offered nothing more than paper towels and insults. Puerto Ricans deserve better. As president, I will always fight for you and your families. And together, we can chart a new way forward.
I'm Kamala Harris, and I approve this message.
Now, we should say that the Trump campaign, after the enormous outcry, after Bad Bunny endorsed Kamala Harris right after all of this took place, the Trump campaign released a statement saying this joke, talking about the so-called comedian, talking about Puerto Rico as an island of garbage, this joke does not reflect the views of President Trump or the campaign. Danielle Alvarez, a Trump campaign spokesperson, said in a statement. That was one comment they referred to, but there were many for hours at Madison Square Garden. I want to go back to former Trump White House advisor Stephen Miller, who immediately launched into an anti-immigrant racist tirade when he took the stage at Madison Square Garden.
Who's going to stand up and say the cartels are gone, the criminal migrants are gone, the gangs are gone, America is for Americans and Americans only?
America is for Americans and Americans only. Now, Jean Guerrero, you are an expert on Steve Miller. You wrote a book about him, Hate Monger Stephen Miller, Donald Trump and the White Nationalist Agenda. People don't usually get to see him speaking unless they're at some of the rallies where he introduces President Trump. But he is very prominent in writing speeches and in creating and in working with Trump on this particular issue. Your comment on his significance and in a new Trump administration where so many of the officials have left Trump at this point in his former administration, but not Stephen Miller.
Exactly. He is one of Trump's most trusted advisors who shaped his immigration agenda, including the family separation policy, as you noted earlier, Amy. And when he says that America is for Americans only, it's extremely important to note that when it comes to a second Trump presidency, it's not only undocumented immigrants who would be deemed undesirable and disposable. It would also be Puerto Ricans, as we saw from this racist rally, even though Puerto Ricans are American citizens. It would also target legal immigrants. If Trump revives the Alien Enemies Act, as he vows to do, countless legal immigrants would be subject to mass internment and expulsion. But it doesn't even end with the foreign-born. When it comes to the vision of Stephen Miller and his and Trump's other close allies, when they talk about Americans only, they're talking about the far right only. And I know this based on the fact that when Trump talks about a quote-unquote enemy within, he is echoing the title of a book called The Enemy Within that was written by Stephen Miller's longtime mentor, a man named David Horowitz. And in this book, The Enemy Within, the entire political left is framed as an existential threat to the United States, one that must be defeated at all costs. And so when you listen to Stephen Miller talk about Americans only, a lot of people might feel safe thinking like, oh, you know, like I was born in the United States. A lot of Latino voters who are voting for Trump might think that they are immune from these expulsions and these really terrorizing plans that they have in place for the Latino community. But that's absolutely wrong. They're not going to stop with people who are undocumented. They're not going to stop even with the foreign born. If you are a liberal, if you believe in compassion and equality and freedom for all, you do not belong in Trump's America. You are American only in the American only vision if you embrace hatred, if you embrace division, and if you embrace this exclusionary vision of America where only certain people who fit the white nationalist agenda belong.
Jean Guerrero, we want to thank you for being with us, contributing opinion writer for The New York Times, author of Hate Monger, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump, and the White Nationalist Agenda, and Crux, a cross-border memoir, which won a Penn Literary Award. Coming up next, we speak with Ruth Ben-Ghiat, a New York University professor and fascism expert. We'll also speak with a journalist who looked back at Madison Square Garden in an Oscar-nominated film, 1939, a Nazi rally held in the middle of New York City. Stay with us.
You take what they give you and you keep it inside. Every spark of friendship and love will die without a home. Hear the soldier groan, glad it alone. Take me out of here. Don't wanna fight, don't wanna die. Just wanna hear you cry. Who's gonna throw the very first stone?
Intervention by Arcade Fire. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Vice President Kamala Harris makes her closing arguments to voters tonight at the Ellipse near the White House, where Donald Trump gave his speech on January 6, 2021, just before his supporters rioted at the Capitol. Trump made his closing argument Sunday at Madison Square Garden. As he did so, local Democratic socialists protested nearby at Bryant Park. For more on Trump's closing arguments and the rise of the authoritarian right, we're joined by Ruth Ben-Ghiat, expert on fascism and authoritarianism. She's the author of Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present, and a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University. She also publishes the newsletter Lucid, on threats to democracy. Professor, welcome back to Democracy Now! In these lead-up to this final week of the election, if you can talk about the comments of President Trump, everything from arresting his enemies to the enemy within, and what this echoes for you.
Yeah, so, you know, fascism started almost 100 years ago in both Italy and Germany with a corps of combatants from World War I who brought the war home and turned their wrath and their force and their violence on liberals, on leftists, on progressive priests, on anybody who did not was not in their leader cults. And so when Donald Trump talks about America being an occupied country that he's going to liberate, this is the language also of Francisco Franco. This is the language of fascism and violence. And, you know, when we think about all the dehumanizing rhetoric and the explicit references to Hitler's Germany, you know, Trump doesn't want people comparing him to Hitler. He even sued CNN for $475 million, claiming they were comparing him to Hitler. But he himself has, his campaign has explicitly made these parallels, even releasing a campaign ad that talked about him creating a, quote, unified Reich, and, of course, calling people vermin. And I want to say something about the use of profanity and the crudeness of all of these remarks at the Madison Square Garden rally, which, of course, was the site of American Nazi rally. Because we think about authoritarianism as imposing controls on people and silencing people, and it certainly does that. But it also is designed, from fascism forward, to make people become their worst selves, to give them permission to be as violent and unrestrained as possible. And so deregulation, just as, you know, Project 2025 wants to deregulate environmental protections and food safety things following what happened during the Trump presidency, there's also a deregulation of inhibitions, of morals, and so that you will be not less bothered when the violence starts. You will turn the other cheek or you will participate in it. And this kind of profanity, you know, at women, the misogyny, anti-Black statements, the calling Latinos garbage, it's not only a tradition of dehumanization that starts with fascism and goes through authoritarian movements up to our day. It's also designed to make people feel, the foot soldiers of MAGA, that there are no restraints, there are no controls, and everything will be accepted as long as it is in the service of targeting the enemy within.
I wanted to go to two clips of Donald Trump, and these have become quite familiar. He called for the National Guard or U.S. military to be deployed on U.S. soil to target what he called radical left lunatics. Trump made the call, at least this particular one, he said it repeatedly, during an interview on Fox News.
I think the bigger problem are the people from within. We have some very bad people. We have some sick people, radical left lunatics. And I think they're the—and it should be very easily handled by, if necessary, by National Guard, or if really necessary, by the military, because they can't let that happen.
And this is Donald Trump speaking in Aurora, Colorado, earlier this month.
It's the enemy from within, all the scum that we have to deal with that hate our country. That's a bigger enemy than China and Russia.
And of course, we know what John Kelly said, his former longest-lasting chief of staff, the general who called him the definition of a fascist. Your response, Professor Benguia.
So, you know, retired military officers, especially generals, don't speak out unless they feel there's a real need to do so. And the fact we're seeing General Kelly, General Milley, former Defense Secretary Esper speak out and use the F word, calling Trump a fascist, means that, you know, they are highly concerned about the, a possible misuse of the military. Because, again, this goes back when Trump talks about scum and perhaps needing to use the military against them. This echoes, you know, Francisco Franco and the whole discourse of the subhuman, which was integral to fascism. But there's also a geopolitical dimension. It's very important because if you're Putin or Xi or North Korea, and you know, have your expansionist aspirations, the power and professionalism of the U.S. military is a huge problem. The global reach of the U.S. military is a huge problem. So here comes Donald Trump, who's the latest partner of Putin. There's been Gerhard Schroeder, Silvio Berlusconi. Now we have Trump, who wants to give the U.S. military a new role, concentrating them on domestic repression, withdrawing from NATO, with calling troops back from abroad. And so we have to think about who benefits geopolitically from this rerouting of the military. I'm not saying the military would go along with this, but this is what Trump is saying by when he declares repeatedly, and as does J.D. Vance, that the bigger problem, you know, Russia and China are not the biggest problem. It's the enemy within. So this refocusing of military and armed force on American people benefits Putin, benefits Xi, benefits any autocrat who has expansionist ambitions.
That's right. Good.
I want to bring into this discussion Marshall Curry. Marshall Curry went to the Madison Square Garden event. But he also did an Oscar-nominated film. That film was called A Night at the Garden, about the 1939 Nazi rally at Madison Square Garden. This is a clip.
Ladies and gentlemen, fellow Americans, American patriots, I am sure I do not come before you tonight as a complete stranger. You all have heard of me through the Jewish-controlled press as a creature with horns, a cloven hoof, and a long tail. We, with American ideals, demand that our government shall be returned to the American people who founded it.
If you ask what we are actively fighting for under our charter, first, a social just white Gentile ruled United States. Second, Gentile-controlled labor union free from Jewish Moscow-directed domination.
A Night at the Garden. That was an excerpt not of Nazi Germany, but of a Nazi rally at Madison Square Garden in 1939 from the Academy Award-nominated short film directed by Marshall Curry. That voice, explain what we just saw and listened to, and the person, the protester who came up and was beaten up.
Sure. So in 1939, there was a rally in Madison Square Garden where 20,000 New Yorkers gathered to celebrate the rise of Nazism. And when I first saw that footage, I was completely shocked to see the American flag and George Washington and, you know, hear people singing the Star Spangled Banner and saying the Pledge of Allegiance and then offering the stiff-armed salute and cheering white supremacy. So the man who was speaking was named Fritz Kuhn. He was the head of the German-American Bund, which had camps all around the country, had quite a big following and some significant power. The protester who runs out on stage and is beaten up was a man named Isidore Greenbaum, who was a Jewish plumber's assistant who just went to the rally that night to find out what was going on and was shocked and appalled by what he saw.
And you went to Madison Square Garden Sunday?
I did. So I made this film 7 years ago with out of archival material that we'd sort of found in the National Archive and UCLA's archive and Grinberg Archive. That was, you know, 7 years ago at the beginning of Trump's administration. I saw some similarities between some of the demagoguery that was happening on stage in 1939 and what Trump was doing at his rallies. And so, but I'd never actually seen a Trump rally personally. And so when I heard that he was going to be at Madison Square Garden, I thought I needed to go and see it for myself.
And Marshall Curry, as you mentioned, you're surprised. Many Americans are not aware of how extensive the fascist and Nazi movement was in the U.S. Back in those days. Could you talk about that?
Sure. I mean, when I grew up, I always learned in school that America took on the fascists and we fought the Nazis and defeated them. And we did. And that's a great, you know, point of pride for our country. But we were not entirely united. As today, there were people in our midst who were anti-Semites, who were anti-immigrant. And I think the thing that struck me the most about seeing that footage was the way that the demagogues in 1939 used the same tactics that we see today. You know, they use this kind of dark humor. They wrap their ideology and the symbols of patriotism, and they go after immigrants and the press and minority religions, and they do it to distract people from the fact that they really want to cut taxes for rich people and take away health care and do policies that people wouldn't support.
And I'd like to ask Ruth Ben-Ghiat, this Madison Square rally has happened numerous times in U.S. history. People forget that in 1968, when George Wallace, the white supremacist governor, was running for president, he held a rally at Madison Square Garden in October of 1968, and it was filled as well with segregationists right here in New York City. And in fact, the police were picking up people in the streets, anyone who was trying to protest the Wallace rally. I know because I was a young college student at the time, trying to get down to Madison Square Garden, was picked up by the police blocks away from Madison Square Garden, and we were held in vans until after the rally was over, hundreds of people. the reality is that filling Madison Square Garden is really not that hard for a political movement. You're talking about less than a metropolitan area of 20 million people. Being able to get 20,000 zealots in an arena is basically two-tenths of 1% of the population.
Yes. And the other thing is that this rally, all the different strains of it, playing Dixie, this Trump rally, Trump has always provided a big tent from the very beginning, 2015-16, for every possible kind of racist and extremist in America. He addressed himself to Southern racists, he addressed himself to Proud Boys, to neo-Nazis, famously, at the Charlottesville rally. Every type of person with a grievance, and then enlarged that with espousing great replacement theory. And of course, in partnership with Fox, with the GOP elite, et cetera. And so all of this was represented at this rally, together with people from the fields of business, like the businessman Grant Cardone, who said, we have to slaughter these people, referring to people who aren't supporting Trump. And you had people from the world of entertainment and from sports. And so Madison Square Garden, a seat of spectacles and sports spectacles, entertainment spectacles, political spectacles, was the perfect place, actually, for MAGA to show how many people are fitting into its big tent of racism and extremism.
Ruth Benguia, I want to thank you for being with us, expert on fascism and authoritarianism, wrote the book Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. Her newsletter is called Lucid on Threats to Democracy. And we want to thank Marshall Curry, director of the Oscar-nominated short film A Night at the Garden, about the Nazi rally at Madison Square Garden in 1939. When we come back, as billionaire Washington Post owner Jeff Bezos defends his decision to block the paper from endorsing Kamala Harris, we'll speak with the Pulitzer Prize-winning Post reporter David Huffman, who's resigned from the Post editorial board in protest, and with Los Angeles Times editorials editor Mariel Garza. She resigned after the L.A. Times billionaire owner also blocked the board's endorsement of Harris. Back in 20 seconds.
I'll always be less than zero. Oh yeah. You tried your best for me, I know. I couldn't face you with my darkest truth of all. Oh, oh, oh. 'Cause I can't get.
Less than zero by the weekend. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Los Angeles Times and The Washington Post are facing mounting backlash after the paper's publishers announced no presidential endorsements would be made this year. The L.A. Times is owned by billionaire Patrick Soon-Shiong, and The Washington Post is owned by Amazon's Jeff Bezos. NPR's reporting more than 200,000 people have canceled their Washington Post subscriptions and counting. A number of journalists have also resigned, including the editorials editor at The Los Angeles Times, Mariel Garza, who wrote, how could we spend 8 years railing against Trump and the danger his leadership poses to the country and then fail to endorse the perfectly decent Democrat challenger who we previously endorsed for the U.S. Senate? unquote. Veteran journalists Robert Greene and Karen Klein have also resigned from the L.A. Times editorial board. At The Washington Post, David Huffman and Molly Roberts both resigned on Monday from the Post editorial board. Michelle Norris also resigned as a Washington Post columnist, and Robert Kagan resigned as editor-at-large. David Huffman, who just won a Pulitzer Prize for his series Annals of Autocracy, wrote, quote, "I believe we face a very real threat of autocracy in the candidacy of Donald Trump. I find it untenable and unconscionable that we've lost our voice at this perilous moment." David Huffman joins us now, along with former Los Angeles Times editorials editors Mariel Garza. David Huffman, let's begin with you. Explain why you left The Washington Post's editorial board. Oh, and at the same time, congratulations on your Pulitzer Prize.
Thank you very much. I worked for 12 years writing editorials in which I said over and over again, we cannot be silent in the face of dictatorship, not anywhere. And I wrote about dissidents who were imprisoned for speaking out, and I felt that I couldn't write another editorial decrying silence if we were going to be silent in the face of Trump's autocracy. And I feel it very, very strongly that the campaign has exposed his intention to be an autocrat.
And David Huffman, is there any precedent for the publisher of the Washington Post overruling their own editorial board?
Yeah, there's lots of precedent. It's entirely within the right of the publisher and the owner to do this. Previous owners have often told the editorial board what to say because we are the voice of the institution and its owner. So there's nothing wrong with that. What's wrong here is the timing. If they had made this decision early in the year and announced as a principle they don't want to issue endorsements, nobody would have even blinked. A lot of papers don't. People have rightly questioned whether they actually have any impact. What matters here was we are right on the doorstep of the most consequential election in our lifetimes. To pull the plug on the endorsement, to go silent against Trump days before the election, that to me was just unconscionable.
And Mariel Garza, could you talk about the situation at the L.A. Times and your reaction when you heard of the owner's decision?
Certainly. It was a long conversation over the course of many weeks. We presented our proposal to endorse Kamala Harris. And of course, there was no question that we had endorsed her. We spent 9 years talking about the dangers of Trump, called him unfit in 5 million ways. And Kamala Harris is somebody that we know. She's a California elected official. We've had a lot of conversations with her. We've seen her career evolved. We were gonna endorse her. And there was no indication that we were going to suddenly shift from to a neutral position, certainly not within a few weeks or months of the election. At first, we didn't get a clear answer. Sounds like it's the same situation that happened at The Washington Post. Until we pressed for one, we presented an outline with these are the points we're going to make, and an argument for why not only was it important for us, an editorial board whose mission is to speak truth to power, to stand up to tyranny, our readers expect it. We're a very liberal paper. There is no question what the editorial board believes that Donald Trump should not be president ever.
So it was
perplexing. It was mystifying. It was
Mariel, I wanted to get your response to the daughter of the L.A. Times owner. On Saturday, Los Angeles Times owner Patrick Soon-Shiong's daughter, Nika Soon-Shiong, posted a message online suggesting that her father's decision was linked to Kamala Harris's support for Israel's war in Gaza. Nika wrote, quote, "Our family made the joint decision not to endorse a presidential candidate. This was the first and only time I have been involved in the process. As a citizen of a country openly financing genocide and as a family that experienced South African apartheid, the endorsement was an opportunity to repudiate justifications for the widespread targeting of journalists and ongoing war on children, she wrote. Her father, Patrick Soon-Shiong, later disputed her claims, saying she has no role at the Los Angeles Times. Mariel Garza, your response.
I really don't know what to say, because if that was the case, it was never communicated to us. I do not know what goes on in the conversation in the Soon-Shiong household. I know that she does not participate in deliberations of the editorial board, as far as I know. I've never spoken to her. We all know how she feels about Gaza, because she's a prolific tweeter. So I really can't say. And this is part of the bigger problem, is we were never given a reason for why we were being silent. If there was a reason, say it was Israel, we could have explained that to readers. Instead, we remained silent. And this is not a time in American history where anybody can remain silent or neutral.
And David Hoffman, this whole issue has been raised by some critics of Jeff Bezos, that his company has a lot of business with the U.S. government, and whether that had any impact on Bezos' decision. I'm wondering your thoughts.
I can't be inside his mind. His company does have big business, and he's acknowledged it's a complicating factor in his ownership. But I can't really understand why he made this decision, and I don't think it's been very well explained. His explanation published today was that he wants sort of more civic quiet, and he thought an endorsement would add to the sense of anxiety and the poisonous atmosphere. But I disagree with that. I think, like in the LA Times, I think readers have come to expect us to be a voice of reason, and they've looked to endorsements at least for some clarity. So, frankly, I also feel that we're still lacking an explanation.
The subtitle, the slogan of The Washington Post, of course, democracy dies in darkness. It's being mocked all over social media. One person wrote, "Hello, darkness, my old friend." David Hoffman, your response to that. But also, you won the Pulitzer Prize for your series Annals of Autocracy, and you talk about digital billionaires as well and what this means. How does this fit into your investigations?
You know, I would hope everybody would understand and acknowledge that we've done a lot of good for democracy and human rights. I've had governments react sharply to a single editorial. When we call them out for imprisoning dissidents, it matters that we are very widely read. And that's another reason why I feel this was a big mistake, because we actually were on a path for decades of championing democracy and human rights as an institution. And, I have to tell you, I've wrote a book in Russia about oligarchs. I understand how difficult it is when you have a lively and independent group of journalists, and ownership really matters. And, we're not just another widget company. This is actually a group of very, very deep thinking and oftentimes very aggressive people that have a desire to change the world. That's the kind of journalism that the Washington Post has sponsored and engaged in. In 2023, we published a series of editorials that took a look deep inside how China, Russia, Burma, other places, how these autocracies function. One of the findings was that many of these dictatorships are using technology to clamp down on dissent, even things as tiny as a single tweet. young people, young college students, are being thrown in prison in Cuba, in Belarus, in Vietnam. And I documented these to show how this technology actually isn't becoming a force for freedom, but it's being turned on its head by dictatorship.
We have to leave it there. David Hoffman, Washington Post reporter, stepped down from the Post editorial board when they refused to endorse presidential candidate Mariel Garza, LA Times editorials editor who just resigned. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
After an eventful quarterfinal game, your Queens Gales are still running down a dream. And on Saturday, November 2nd, they come face to face with the number one ranked, undefeated Wilfrid Laurier Golden Hawks. The stakes are high and the odds are stacked against the Gales, but this is a team that makes the impossible look routine. Can the Gales continue their incredible underdog run and dream the impossible dream? Or will the Golden Hawks send Queens crashing back to reality? Tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM at 12:45 p.m. for the Something in the Water pregame show ahead of the 1 p.m. kickoff.
I'm stoked. You stoked?
I'm stoked.
Just
I'm
stoked. So stoked.
Ready?
Yeah.